I'm Karen Hartglass. It's time for It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today. I have to tell you, I just had an incredible lunch, and the flavors are still swimming around in my mouth, and I love that when you can continue to enjoy something even after you've finished it. So do you want to know what it was? We had last night a kind of new pesto sauce made with sunflower seeds instead of pine nuts, and it's really yummy. And we had it last night, and I got leftovers for lunch, which was great. And you can get the recipe, because I want to share it. It's so good, at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Just go there right now, and you can grab it. You can see some pictures. It's right there on the homepage. And there's a bunch of other recipes we added this week. I'll tell you about them maybe, if you're lucky, a little later. And you know this show. It's called It's All About Food. We talk about food, whether it's healthy food or not so healthy food. And you know what I'm leading up to, Camille. that's my guest who's losing it before I introduce her. Well, anyway, okay, here we go. So I have Camille DeAngelis on with me today, and she's the author of a new book called Bones and All. She's also the author of Merry Modern and Petty Magic. She's a certified vegan lifestyle coach and educator and is currently veganizing an 18th century Scottish cookbook. She lives in Boston, and you can find her on the web at cometparty.com. Okay, so hi, and how are you doing, Camille?
I'm great, Karen. How are you?
Great. Yeah, so anyway.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. So before you interrupted me with your lovely laughter, I was talking about how we talk about all kinds of food on this show, and some things I don't even consider food are animal foods. I haven't eaten meat mm-hmm. in, like, decades.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things we're going to talk about, based on your fictional book, is eating humans, humans eating humans, cannibalism, some people call it. You just call it being an eater.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the point of the book is that flesh is not food. It's not. It's not
flesh
food. A lot of people eat it.
Food.
It is what we have been indoctrinated to believe is food. For thousands of years, we've been eating it. That doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it ethical. It doesn't make it fair to the animals and to the planet.
You're reminding me of the movie Finding Nemo, which seems to be playing a lot lately on television on one of the stations. We've seen it a few times over and over because we like it. But there's my favorite line in it is, "Fish are your friends, not food."
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we can continue that and say any flesh of any kind is not food.
Mm-hmm.
Even human flesh.
Yeah. So, you know, so the thing that keeps running through my head is that bit in the China study where T. Colin Campbell is talking about how flesh is actually the most easily assimilated protein. So he's like, if you want the most efficient protein, you should eat human flesh, except no, don't do that. That's why would you do that? But that really, you know, I mean, obviously I was already a vegan when I read this book, but I was like, wow, you know, I mean, you could take it to a logical extreme that is completely insane. But what is also insane is eating any other kind of animal protein, I think, and you think too.
Okay, so that was going to be my first question, which you answered already, was there a message in this book that you wrote?
Yeah. So I wrote this book to get people thinking about flesh eating and to get people thinking about themselves as predators, because it's not something that, you know, you're cognizant of, you're conscious of as you're, you know, just kind of mindlessly ordering, you know, your lunch from, like, Chick-fil-A. I mean, not everybody could have sunflower pesto not everybody's having some sunflower pesto for lunch, unfortunately. It sounds delicious. So I wanted to get people thinking about, like, this is predatory. It was really shocking to me when I first kind of put two and two together in that way. And like I said, I, you know, had already gone vegan. I've been vegetarian for many years before that. But that was a real, you know, like a shocking little epiphany for me to have as I was revising the book, because initially, you know, as a fiction writer, I don't want to be, you know, pounding somebody over the head with a message. I want to get them with a really good story. And the story has to come first. And so initially, when I had this idea, writing about this, you know, 16-year-old girl who eats, basically eats anyone, gobbles them up like an ogre in a fairy tale, you know. I got this idea, and it was hilarious to me because it's like, oh, I'm a vegan and I have this ridiculous idea about a cannibal. and so you know, it was actually I have a funny story that I was like, oh, I can't take this seriously, right? But I was actually at Dirt Candy with a couple of friends, one of whom is also a longtime vegetarian, and when I told her this idea, you know, over this like delicious, you know, vegan meal, she just started giggling uncontrollably, and she was like, I think you need to write this. So I started writing it, thinking like, oh, this is just this, you know, hilarious paradox. But then as I started revising it, actually as I was revising it, I was working on the different, you know, reading assignments for Victoria Brand's Main Street Vegan Academy, which is how I got my certification as a vegan lifestyle coach and educator. So I'm reading the China Study as I'm revising the book. And I was also reading Victoria's books, and I read John Robbins' books, and I read The World Peace Diet by Will Tuttle.
Will Tuttle. Mm-hmm.
So all of these books, you know, reading these wonderful, enlightening books made me realize, like, this, I can reach people with this book. This book is, like, much bigger than me just telling a story to entertain you, you know? So it sort of became, you know, this book that I was hoping to sort of have this message, you know, at the end, you know, to have people thinking, like, you know, as they look at my bio and they see that I'm a vegan, they're like, oh, that's funny. You know, and then they're reading the book. Hopefully, you know, they're really into the book. And then at the end, you know, in the acknowledgments, you know, and I just lay it all out there. You know, I'm like, this book is about flesh eating. And so, you know, hopefully, you know, you just get people thinking about it. You know, and I mean, a lot of people aren't like, you know, because when I had my vegan epiphany, it was just boom. Like I didn't do Meatless Mondays. I didn't do any of that stuff. It was just like this is the right way to live my life. Mm-hmm. And so I just, you know, there were no more animal products after that. And I, you know, that was over 4 years ago, and I've been, you know, this has been like the happiest 4 years of my life and the most fulfilling 4 years of my life and the most prolific also. So I'm actually really interested in talking to people about how going vegan can make you more creative. I've actually written about that on Victoria's blog. So,
okay, because you're clearer now. You're not covered up with all kinds of crud and pus and crap. You're clear. Your brain's clear.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And it's fueled. So I wanted to say, I think more and more people are learning that meat, or at least a lot of meat, isn't healthy, and that we really should consume a diet that is plant-centered. But we've known for a long time that eating other humans is really not good for us. But I think it's funny that we're learning that eating other animals isn't good for us either. It's just going to take time. But it's very similar.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really slow sort of unlearning and relearning process for a lot of people. But actually, I went to Vegan Drinks. I know you guys have that in New York, and we have a meetup here in Boston once a month. And I met this guy who had a really interesting prediction. This is like last month's meetup. He said, you know, in about 10 years, I think we're going to reach critical mass. And we're going to have enough vegans and enough, you know, people who are vocal, you know, not in a militant way, but in a just a loving, like, this is the truth kind of way, which is what I'm aiming for. You know, I don't, you know, want to be, I mean, I'm only beating people over the head with my truth, you know, because that's not actually going to do anybody any good. I went to a couple of barbecues yesterday, and, you know, All of the people I was with were, I mean, I was the only vegan there, and I was just, like, you know, quietly eating my veggie burger and my roasted, you know, portobello mushroom and salad and, you know, roasted asparagus and potatoes, and it was delicious. I'm just like, I am just quietly being who I am, and people can follow this example when they're ready, you know.
Now, nobody was asking you about what you were eating?
You know, I was really surprised. I had never actually met any of these people before. This was, like, totally new, and so I was a little bit nervous about it. But everybody was just totally accepting of it. It was really fine. And I actually encountered more, sort of people hassling me about it when back when I was just a vegetarian. People took it as an affront that, and it wasn't even necessarily food that they had prepared. So it wasn't like, your whole, your great aunt, Gertrude or whatever saying like, you don't want to eat the food that I'm trying to nourish you with. Like it wasn't even that. It's just like you could be out somewhere because there's this people have this, they see it as an implicit judgment. I just want to sit and have my meal and we can have a conversation about anything you want to talk about, but it's been actually totally fine. All you can do is just, you're just quietly, eating what you want to eat, what you feel is right to eat, what is, fair and ethical and, honest and compassionate. You just let people take, people take the time that they need to kind of get on board with it, I ran off on a tangent here, but this guy that was saying that, in 10 years, he thinks that we're going to reach critical mass, and so it's going to become a fully mainstream lifestyle choice. And when it totally hits the mainstream, it's already happening, It's like it's never been easier to be vegan. And I think, how, blasé everybody, all these meat eaters were at this these two barbecues that I went to yesterday really just goes to show you how far we've come in the last 10 years. And it's becoming more mainstream, but it will get to the point where everyone will see it as a mainstream lifestyle choice.
Well, I really hope that happens. I can't wait. Ten years is not soon enough, and I hope it happens.
I know.
So let's talk more about your book, Bones and All. I have a few questions and comments. So one of the things is the main character, Marin, who's 16 years old, like you said. In any good story, you want to like the character, the lead character, and go along. And she's definitely very likable. And it's funny because, there is the ick factor of her being an eater and eating humans. But, you're reading about her and you understand her issues and her insecurities and her fears and her relationships. And you want her to succeed, even though she's eating eating humans.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you felt that way because I really wanted her to be identifiable. I mean, and a lot of it is sort of the ordinary teen angst just sort of amplified times.
Yeah,
I don't know, 20, 200. She's a very isolated teen. Obviously because of the thing that she does, and so her mother is every time she does the bad thing, as she calls it, her mother just kind of whisks her away to another town in another state, and they kind of start all over again. This is all in the first couple pages, so I'm not giving anything away for your listeners, but. She eventually has to go out on her own, and that's when she really doesn't want to do the bad thing, but she's on her own, completely alone in the world, and she's just trying to make peace with who she is, or she's trying to not be who she is, and then. Yeah, it's kind of everything that we're all trying to do. I was thinking the other day about personality integration and sort of, this fits into veganism perfectly. I mean, you want to think of yourself as a caring, compassionate person, but you have to, look at every single aspect of your life and are you behaving compassionately, in all of those sectors, not just how you treat other humans.
Okay, I have a question about another character in the book, and his name is Sully, and I'm not going to say any more about him other than he's an older man. But I was wondering what was behind your choice of what was behind him in that he was also an eater and he didn't decide to consume Marin right away. He was kind of following her around. What was behind that?
Well, I'm trying to think of a way to talk about him that isn't spoilery.
Okay, well, then you can tell me offline sometime.
Okay.
I was just kind of curious about that.
Yeah, but he's definitely playing a cat and mouse game with her. She doesn't realize it at first. It's hard to know.
Oh, a cat and mouse game. Okay.
Yeah, Yeah.
All right, so I was heading towards the end, and I was kind of hoping that there would be this redemption somehow, like I mentioned Finding Nemo before and how the sharks in Finding Nemo decide they want to be vegetarian and they're struggling. Or like in the Twilight movie, the good vampires aren't sucking blood from people. They're getting it from animals, unfortunately.
I haven't seen it. I haven't read the books.
Oh, okay. Well, I've seen the movies, and they're horrible. But I don't recommend
them. Because I heard they weren't any good, so that's why I haven't, read any of the books or seen any of the
movies. But I'm wondering, maybe there's going to be a series, and maybe later on Marin will try to abstain from flesh eating?
I have not done a series so far. I'm kind of when I wrap up the world that I've created and I give the characters their fates, I'm on to the next thing, you know? And I hope that I've made my point with this book and, the next thing I do, actually, speaking of the 18th century Scottish cookbook, the little project, my little side project, I have a sort of companion project. It's the main one. My next magnum opus is set in 18th century Edinburgh. And it, part of the story follows a family of Pythagoreans who have an animal rescue thing going on in their house. Like they'll take in injured foxes and things, and they don't eat animals, which is actually less of a freakish thing than you would have thought back then. I mean, there were a lot of people who preachers who were speaking out against flesh eating back then, and it was, it was less feasible to be, to abstain from all animal products. But there was definitely a consciousness of it that you might not have expected. I mean, the word vegetarian wasn't coined, until, the mid 19th century, but there were vegetarians back before that word existed.
There were Pythagoreans a long time ago.
Yes. And so I want to write about them. The story is going to be so fun. I can't wait to write it. But I'm still going to be exploring, vegetarianism and veganism in my future fiction for sure. In a more overt way, which is going to be really fun.
And do you have some Scottish background in you?
I don't actually. I have some Irish ancestry, but no Scottish. I did actually go. I was really fortunate to be granted a residency at this place called Hawthornden Castle outside of Edinburgh, and it's a writer's retreat, a writer's colony. So I went there a couple years ago for a month-long residency, and actually revised Bones and All while I was there. But I was collecting a lot of fun historical tidbits from the different books that I found in the National Library of Scotland, and love walking around the old city and the old town, and soaking up the atmosphere, because you can still feel it. There are a lot of places where the city has become so modern that you can't picture what it would have been like 200 or 300 years ago, but you can picture it very easily in Edinburgh.
No, you can picture it in a lot of European towns. That's what I love about Europe. They build these incredible buildings that have been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I did love Edinburgh. There was a vegetarian restaurant or a vegan restaurant I went to in Edinburgh about 10 years ago, and I got vegan, what's the famous Scottish dish?
Haggis?
Yes.
I've had vegan haggis. It's really good. I think it's made with lentils and walnuts.
I don't remember. It was a long time ago, but it was good.
Really good.
And I don't know what the original version tastes like because I've been vegetarian a very long time. I have another Marin question, the character in your book. Is she based on anyone? Is there any of you in any of the characters?
I mean, there's a little piece of me in every character, I think, and that might be a diplomatic answer, but you have to create this person from somewhere, and you have to give them motivations that feel compelling, I guess I would say if she's based on anybody, she's based on me, in the sense that. I was sort of a little bit of a loner in high school. I definitely remember feeling isolated and lonely, and I felt like people I didn't feel understood, And so that was what I grew on, when I was fleshing out her character, as it were. So I guess I would say that, you know, she's based on me, but only in that sense.
Right. So you're in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's some great places for vegan food. Do you have some favorites?
I do. There's actually a really great place, like a 10-minute walk from me. I live in Somerville, and so there's a place in Teal Square called True Bistro, which does the most delicious brunch. It's really, really good. We have a couple of really good vegetarian places. You know, I wish they were vegan, but I understand why one of them isn't. So it's called Veggie Galaxy, Teal Square in Cambridge. They sort of specialize in getting meat eaters in the door because it's very like 1950s dinery kind of thing. And then you look at the menu, it's full of comfort food. It's heaven for vegans too, because everything is, you can get everything vegan. They have omelets and stuff like that, which like I said, not thrilled about, but like they have a lot of people who like ordinarily would never, ever, ever go to a vegetarian restaurant will go there, and then it starts to feel accessible. And so then they're more open to it. So I understand why they do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like that place. We have Life Alive in Central Square in Cambridge as well. And there's the Walnut Grill in Newton Highlands. That's really good. There's a place called Mai Tai downtown in Chinatown. There's Coco Bee, which is more of a takeout place. I want there to be even more places, that's why I love coming down to New York, because it's just like, yeah! Like last time I was there, after Victoria's book launch last week, I went to Blossom, and it's like, yeah.
Oh, that's where we went. Oh my gosh. I missed you.
Oh my gosh, I don't know how I missed, that's okay.
Yeah.
I don't know how, we had the bookstore a long time, chit-chatting with, all my friends that I don't get to see very often, so. But we've got some really good places here. I just wish there were more of them.
Okay, so you mentioned omelets at that one restaurant, and that just triggered a little something. So I just posted a bunch of recipes on my website, responsibilityandliving.com, and one of the recipes is this French herbed no egg omelet. And I don't know if you've ever played with soca or garbanzo bean flour, but they make incredible omelets, and I'm just like nuts for them lately. So I go through these phases, and I'm in my no egg omelet phase, and just had one that was just so good. So one day in 10 years or so, like you said, we'll be there.
I hope that guy is right.
Yeah. Now, can you tell me what Comet Party means? Your website is cometparty.com.
So I have been, I'm trying to remember at what point I first heard about the concept of a comet party. When Halley's Comet, 1911, I think, I was looking through some old newspapers, maybe the history book, and I found these newspaper write-ups about the comet parties that were happening for the comet sighting. And I was just like, oh my gosh, like that is the coolest reason to have a party, So then I started thinking about it in terms of a metaphor of, that being your best and brightest self, celebrating life, the positivity of that, getting together to celebrate something that is so much bigger than you, celebrating this comet. It sort of became entwined with my veganism, because I believe that this is so much bigger than me. What I eat affects a lot of other people besides me, and it affects non-human people. It's funny because like when I say people now, I'm also thinking non-human people, because I love the concept of a non-human person. And I was explaining this to somebody who studies animals recently, and she was actually more open to it than I thought she would be. I'm feeling really hopeful about that. But yeah, so that's
well,
what
come
the comment
on. If legally a corporation can be considered a person. Why can't a non-human animal? I mean, really?
Right.
Okay, yeah. I want to mention one last thing before we go. Are you familiar with the musical Sweeney Todd?
Yes, but I haven't seen it.
Okay, well, I've performed in it a number of times. I think it's my
favorite
piece. I played Joanna, the 16-year-old little unfortunate ward of this evil judge. And when her father comes back to London to get vengeance and find his wife who's gone nuts, it's a complicated story. He hooks up in his old barber shop with this woman underneath who has a pie shop, and he wants to get the judge in his shop so he can cut his throat and kill him. So he's practicing, and he's practicing on other people, lonely people, and then they have to decide what to do with the bodies. So they end up, since it's London in the industrial age and people are poor and meat is hard to find, they end up cutting the bodies and putting them into meat pies. And the pie maker's business is flourishing. Nobody knows, of course. but when the pie maker first suggests to the barber that this is what they can do, they sing a duet, and it's called Have a Little Priest. And she talks about the different kinds of people and how they might taste. It's quite comic. It's really fun. And I want to play that at the end of this segment, so I just wanted you to know what it's going to be about. And it's just the segment we're going to play is just the last bit of the song. You're not going to hear most of it, but it's a recording that I have, me and my partner Gary. We're called the Swinging Gourmets, and I wanted to end with that. So, Camille, I want to thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. And thank you for this enjoyable read, bones and all. I look forward to seeing you at more big veg events here and there.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brian. I had a great time.
Great, thank you. So I'm going to say goodbye, and then we'll hear the end of Have a Little Priest. Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and we're back for the second part of today's It's All About Food show. What did you think of the first part? Cannibalism. It's kind of a fun concept, isn't it? Anyway, if you have some thoughts, let me know at info@realmeals.org. You know how I always love to get your reaction on some of the things going on this program. All right, now, this is going to be fun because I'm going to bring on a dear old friend, someone who I've never met, but I feel close to. Alan Rodiger now has a new cookbook we're going to be talking about, Almond Milk Cookbook. He's a writer, food designer, blogger, and public speaker. He has served clients as a private chef in the U.S., Europe, and Australia. Raised in Mexico City, has acquired a taste for exotic food early on and soon developed a passion for flavor and beauty that drives his diverse creative culinary style. He's passionate about empowering people to make smart choices in what they eat and to enjoy eating well at home. And we've talked about some of his other cookbooks on this show, Speed Vegan, Extraordinary Vegan, and Paleo Vegan, which showcase his ability to bring health and pleasure together in a wide range of dishes that are simultaneously sophisticated and accessible for the home cook. Alan, my friend, welcome.
My dear, how are you?
Good. Virtual hugs back to you.
Love the way you read my bio. Can you be my herald from now on?
Yes. I'm a voiceover artist, and I can do just about anything. Because I'm plant-powered. Thank you.
Unstoppable.
Yes. Extraordinary vegans we are.
Indeed.
Yes. Anyway, the question is, Alan, why have you been avoiding me?
I've not been avoiding you.
How come you haven't made me a meal?
Oh, I just haven't been in the same place at the same time. That's the only reason, I assure you.
I mean, it's been years now, really.
I know. People are going to start talking about us.
Anyway, Alan used to join me from time to time when I did the Ask a Vegan show, which I still have episodes archived on the Responsible Eating and Living website. Lots of good information in those programs. And you've also been on this show. You know, I haven't counted, and I probably should, but just like Dave Letterman counts, or on Saturday Night Live, the guests who count how many times they've been on the program, you're probably one who's been on more often than most.
And I have something on David Letterman. He's off the air, and I'm on the air.
Okay, very good. Woo. Now, let's get to the matter at hand, which is almond milk. Now, one of the nice things about your cookbooks is they tend to be small and digestible, not overwhelming.
You haven't been eating the books, have you?
Yeah. Well, we were just talking to Camille DeAngelis, who was talking about eating people, human people. So, you know, anything goes here.
Can't wait to get the podcast on that one.
It's fiction. But it's fun. Okay. It's fun fiction. So the first thing that I loved in this cookbook was pretty much the first page of text where you talk about almonds in history. Can we get a voiceover on that? Almonds in history. I needed a little more reverb, but that'll do. And fascinating. Can you tell us a little bit about almonds in history?
Well, you know, I did a little research because I've just been eating almonds. I haven't really been paying too much attention to their history. And it turns out that in the Middle Ages, almond milk was far more ubiquitous in cooking than dairy milk.
Ubiquitous is a big word for us here.
Oh, you know, like everywhere?
Okay, yes.
Except, you know, not like divine, but, you know, like pretty much every kitchen. Every single Middle Ages cook knew how to make almond milk and made it as a routine every day because dairy milk was expensive. You had to have a cow, which you had to buy a cow. Then you had to feed the cow. Uh-huh. You had to make sure the cow didn't get sick and die. And this was something that landowners had. This is something, you know, even the small farmers, many of them were kind of owned by somebody who had a castle, and they just were there for, you know, their benefit. And they didn't actually own their land. They didn't actually own their cattle or whatever. They just took care of it.
Mm.
So in order to have dairy milk, you had to be rich, and you had to be, you know, stationary. You couldn't be wandering around. So almonds, of course, are totally transportable, and you can make almond milk on the spot and use it right away, or you can leave it for a day and nothing's going to happen to it, whereas dairy milk, you leave it for an afternoon and it's spoiled. So
right.
Almond milk was what they used for all the recipes, and I didn't know that. So it's kind of exciting, actually.
It is exciting, and I love the point that you mentioned. Not only is dairy milk very perishable, but the fact that you can hang on to almonds in their shell for an indefinite period of time if they're stored in a cool, dry place. And you can have milk anytime you want it. It's ready as soon as you soak and blend up those almonds. Done. No refrigeration.
And in those days, they didn't even soak them. They just ground them and then mix them with water, sometimes hot water.
Okay, and now how did they grind them? Because they didn't have Vitamixers then.
No, they had the old-fashioned Vitamix.
A mortar and pestle
with almond in the middle.
Like a mortar and pestle?
They used to have very large mortars because they used to do a lot of grinding nuts and seeds and everything. I mean, they didn't have grinders. Most, you know, kitchens didn't anyway.
Okay, maybe that's a great a startup concept for somebody in Brooklyn or Chicago to get one of these giant solar-powered mortar and pestles to ground up nuts and
muscle
seeds.
Power, that's what they used. They didn't have solar. Just sitting there and pounded in a little hole and bam, bam, bam until it was powder. Yeah. And they had a lot of people hanging around the kitchen with, you know, nothing to do except tell me what to do, and then they'd give it to them, like little scullery maids and those kinds of people.
Right, and you have a little paleo background because you had done that book with Ellen Jaffe Jones on vegan paleo, and this almond milk also fits in the paleo scene because they don't believe in dairy either. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to the very early days of cuisine when people just got a rock and mashed a leaf up with it and then rubbed it in something and put it together with something and made a little marinade or something, make something taste a little better. That's it. It goes right back to those old days when they were just grinding things up and trying to make something taste good.
So it's natural.
Yeah, totally.
Whatever natural means. Now, almonds are also good for us. Now, some people talk about how the packaged forms of almond milk, the kind we can get in the grocery store, just kind of like sugary water or something that doesn't have much nutritional value. But making almond milk ourselves, there's nothing wrong with it. It's only good.
Right. I mean, what they sell in the store is kind of intended just to replace milk as an ingredient, you know, like to put in your tea or to put in your cereal or to, you know, stuff that you would normally use dairy milk for. People that are making the transition to something a little healthier, that gives them a quick and easy way to do that. It's not really meant for nutrition. I mean, there is a little calcium they add to it, and there's some that's existing in the almond, but if you make your own almond milk, like when I make ice cream or if I'm using it in a soup or a sauce where I want it really creamy, I do two cups of almonds to four cups of water. Now, in the stuff that you get in the store, it's more like, you know, a tablespoon of almonds to four cups of water.
Yeah, with a lot of other...
And they make it thick with thickeners, and they make it stay, you know, milky with, emulsifiers and stuff. You don't need to do that if you're making your own. The only caveat is that you have to use it within a few days because it's fresh and it will eventually spoil after a few days.
And that's where I want to say you buy food and then you have to eat it. Or you make something and then you have to eat it. And that's the way it works successfully.
In the old days, they didn't even wait. In the paleo period, I mean, you want to go back, they just grabbed it off the bush and ate it. And maybe they would find some that they could stick in their little pouch, but that would they would eat for dinner. There was no next day, 3 days from now, next month. Oh, what's this? Never happened.
But we have a terrible situation with wasting a lot of food in this country. People buy food and it just goes bad in the refrigerator. They don't eat it.
Yeah, and that's a sad story, but that's not even the half of it. Because my son works at Whole Foods, and he tells me that they have to throw food that's expired, and even though it's still perfectly good, it just has a date on it time's up. They have to get rid of it.
And they go back to the manufacturer,
and the manufacturer has to eat it, and not the food, but they have to eat the cost.
Oh, eat it!
Then there's actual fresh food from the case, you know, from the little grazing area, mm-hmm. and they have to throw that away too. They can't give it to anyone. Give it to the employees.
That's the crazy part, how they can't give it to anyone. Because a lot of this stuff is really good. And that's where the freegans and dumpster divers come in to save the day. Not that that's something that I entirely encourage, but I did.
It's hardly a lifestyle you want to emulate.
Well, you know, I have some friends that are serious dumpster divers. It's almost too easy to do in Manhattan, unfortunately. And there's so much good food that's put on the street, and a lot of it is packaged and clean. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
But I did go on a few dumpster diving adventures about 10 years ago. I learned a lot. I was horrified, and I don't think it's changed very much since then. We need to figure that out. That's a piece of the food system equation that's very broken. But anyway, let's get back to almonds because that's the happy story.
La la la.
Now, you have recipes for almond milk, rich almond milk, and almond cream.
Yes.
They're all easy,
and they're
just varied by the ratio of almonds to water. You choose.
That's right. How thick do you want it?
How thick do you want it?
Yeah.
And they all have their purpose. And then you use them in all of these wonderful recipes in your book.
Thank you. Yes, I did.
You're welcome. Now, I recently started making almond cream, and I think I discovered a version of it in... It's some kind of, I want to get it right, vegan holiday cooking from Candle Cafe.
Never seen that book.
Yes, it came out at the end of last year for the big winter holidays, and they had a lovely soup recipe that I made, not exactly, because I don't know how to follow recipes exactly. It's like a flaw in me, but they did use the almond cream, and such a good thing to put on soup or anything.
Yeah. And then if you flavor it, you can actually pair it with something where it goes. Like the almond crema, you know, to make it look sort of like that Mexican cream that they use. Somewhere between sour cream and milk, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. Chili ancho crema.
Yeah. I had a whole bunch of them, and my editor made me trim it down, you know, because I get carried away.
Well, you could add them to your blog.
I will.
Yeah, don't lose them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they're not lost. They're just in a different folder.
Yeah. So when people are always complaining, I can't give up cheese. And although these aren't really cheeses, they're thick, creamy. They're kind of like ricotta cheese recipes almost.
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, here's another thing that didn't make it into the book was I had an almond milk kefir.
Ooh.
That was incredible. And then my editor said, because those kefir starters are dairy based, even though they don't have any milk in them, they're dairy based, so it's not vegan. And then I did some research. No one's going to want to hear this.
Mm-hmm.
All the kefirs and all the yogurts, whether they say vegan on them or not, they all come from dairy. They don't have any dairy in them, but the original culture is grown on dairy products. And then they make it into a little powder so you can pour it into your whatever you're going to grow kefir on.
But some of those cultures may have originated from dairy, but they don't use dairy to feed them or continue them anymore.
Right, but they are, in other words, in vegan terms, they're tainted. You know what I mean? They go back to the, in a sense,
right.
Anyway, I said it, that's done. Okay,
I'm not worrying about it. Hair splitting.
There's a lot of bacteria in the air
that we can use to culture our food. And who knows where it comes from.
Not necessarily in a good way.
Well, I think when given a chance, all bacteria can be good. Are you a good bacteria or are you a bad bacteria? I think they go both ways.
I think it's like poison is in the dosage. It depends on how we have salmonella in us and E. coli and everything else. It's a question of how much it proliferates and does it start to become a problem. I think, does it make you sick or is it just kind of floating around in there?
Okay, I have a question about what's not in this book. And maybe I'm wrong, but I didn't notice any recipes with nutritional yeast. Is that true?
It may very well be because I use nutritional yeast mostly for like when I steam vegetables, I put some of that Udo's oil on it and garlic, and then nutritional yeast, I just pack it on there because it tastes really good.
But I never once
thought of mixing it with milk.
Right. Well, I was thumbing through and looking through the recipes and going, oh, that looks good. And then towards the end, I thought, I don't think I saw nutritional yeast once. Now, I just noticed that because I tend to put it in everything.
Well, I'll have to start doing that and see how it works.
Yeah, but I think it pairs very nicely with thick cream.
It does, now that I think of it. You know, and in fact, there's a recipe that my editor made me do was put a bunch of recipes in there that would be, the idea behind this book was not to get somebody to go vegan. The idea was to get them, give them a way to make stuff that they normally make with mm-hmm. almond milk instead of dairy milk. Give it like a stepping stone for them.
Yeah.
Not trying to convert anyone, just trying to give them a way to use almond milk in new ways, but also in the old ways, like making biscuits and, you know, all that stuff that I never eat and don't recommend, but they're going to want it, so we got to give them a recipe for it.
Absolutely, because we're all on a different, the same path, but we're all in different places on that food continuum.
Yeah, some of us are off trudging through the weeds wondering where the path is.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm looking at cream of mushroom soup, which...
Yeah, that one's tolerable.
Tolerable?
No, it's fine.
It's good.
Editors have a way of shredding your recipes, you know, and doing things to them. But which ones you have to try. The kohlrabi soup is really, really good.
Okay.
Really, really good.
Well, most people don't know what to do with kohlrabi.
I know, and it's such a fantastic vegetable. Of course, you do have to peel quite a bit off the outside so you can chew it.
Mm-hmm.
But the heart of that thing is delicious. Somewhere between a broccoli and then an artichoke or something. It's really good.
Okay, kohlrabi soup. And Chef Rottinger also recommends?
Oh, I recommend highly, 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 one of the five best things I've ever made, the chocolate almond ice cream. And it's so easy.
Mmm. Everybody loves ice cream.
And anybody who doesn't love chocolate, I have to wonder about. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, now I'm thinking of, I don't know why I'm going this way, but I remember back in the days when I did consume cow's milk. It was a long time ago. But I remembered trying frozen ice milk, like ice cream made with milk instead of cream or whatever.
My mother tried to get me to eat that when I was
kidding.
Are you kidding me?
I liked it. There was something. There was something I liked about it, and I find that when I've made almond milk recipes, they remind me of that a little bit. Only better, of course. But
not if you make the rich almond milk.
Oh, rich almond milk.
With 2 cups of nuts with 4 cups of water.
Yes.
Very creamy.
No, maybe the almond milk, maybe the frozen maybe the frozen ice milk varieties I tried were flavored with almond, and maybe that's where I got the almond idea from. I don't know.
I don't know either, but my mother tried to give me these, and it was just, no.
Ugh.
I used to put cream on my cereal, okay, so I was not about to eat.
Goodness, you were like gourmand from way back.
You know, my mother knew she had a problem child on her hands when I was a baby. She had a little satin pillow. I remember, I don't know how I can remember it because I was so young, but I remember it had little rainbow stripes on it. It was satin. It was a little baby pillow. And she put a flannel pillowcase on it. And every time she'd come in to check on me, I would have pulled the flannel off and I'd be lying there with my face on the satin. She knew, okay, this kid's going to be something to deal with.
Yeah. All right, I want to talk about the bad rap almonds have been getting with respect to the California drought.
It's not the almonds' fault.
Hello? It's not the almonds' fault.
No, it's not the almonds. And, if somebody gets a bad rap, it should be the meat and dairy industry who are really using a ton of water to no particular good.
Exactly. So don't feel bad about eating almonds, even if they're from California. We need to get this whole thing figured out. The thing is, ditch the dairy, ditch the meat, and we'll be a lot better
off. Don't cry for the almondino.
Oh, I've got to add that to my repertoire.
There you go. I thought you'd like that. Just came from just like that.
Now, what about babies and almond milk?
Apparently, it's not good for infants. It might be too hard for them to digest.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you want to give them milk, it should come from their mama.
Exactly.
This was intended for them.
Yeah. Unfortunately, some mamas can't, but almond milk is not.
But some of them just don't try hard enough.
Yeah.
I thought, my wife could have given up, when my son was born. It wasn't easy. It really wasn't.
Yeah.
But she kept at it because she really wanted to breastfeed.
Yeah.
And eventually it all kind of clicked. But, I could see how somebody who, has maybe no education about it or no understanding about it or grew up on formula and figures what's the difference, they might just go, oh, this is just not going to work and give up.
Sure, there's a lot of misinformation. But there are a small amount of women who really, for one reason or another, cannot.
Yeah, yeah.
They can either use milk from another woman, I remember reading a few weeks ago some horror stories about that, about how some human milk that you can buy online was mixed with dairy milk.
I thought someone was making ice cream, breast milk ice cream.
Oh, well, I mean, that's a whole other thing.
But maybe mixing it with dairy.
Yeah, mixing with dairy when people didn't know it was mixed with dairy, and that's nasty, cruel.
Miscegenation of the species. It's kind of weird.
Yeah. Anyway, back to almond milk.
We seem to veer off, don't we?
So, whose idea was it to do an almond milk book? Yours or your editor's?
Oh, no, it was my publisher's. Actually, really kind of like, we have a confession to make. This is really their book, and they got me to write it because I write good books.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's how these other items got in there. I had a big fight with him over it. I was like, no, I can't put stuff in there like white flour. And I've already done one cooking demo at Natural Grocers, and the book was going around. Somebody was passing the book around. It wasn't even about the almond milk because they didn't have enough time to get the books in. But so they were passing one around, and somebody in the back goes, "White flour."
I know.
Not my fault.
It's so hard We're, because, I know, we want to do what's best for the world. We want to show people how they can eat nutritiously and deliciously, and do it in a loving, non-judgmental way. Everybody's in a different place on that food continuum. And you, it's like you can't win no matter what you do. You're either too extreme,
well, yeah,
too rigid, or not extreme enough.
Yeah.
And
no, that's why
them.
I just stick to my guns. You know, I know I'm not going to win in terms of, you know, like making, pleasing everyone or making everyone think that I'm doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I figure if I feel that I'm doing the right thing, then I don't care what anybody thinks. You know, because I'm doing it for myself. I'm doing the best that I can.
All right.
And
what
that's
would...
that's where I got a little irked, because I was like, I was kind of like, there was a chain around my neck and they were jerking me back.
Oh. So I want to know, in some of these recipes where you do use white flour.
White flour?
What would you use instead?
I wouldn't make that recipe. I don't make pancakes. I mean, I know you like to bake, and I'm sure you have a lot of good substitutes.
Mm-hmm.
But I figure, you know, because I come from a long history of doing certain things really well. And I would rather do new things really well than try to make the old things not so well, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So if I look at a recipe like that I used to make, well, like, I mean, like I don't know, profiteroles. They have ice cream inside, and they're made with eggs, butter, milk.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there's no way you're going to make it the same.
Oh, no, I've made them, and they're better.
Okay, well, we'll have to get together. You make
we have to get together. Yes, I love doing things like that. Making, I've recently made vegan cannolis that were pretty damn good.
I wasn't terribly fond of the Sicilian regular old cannolis, but...
Oh, my God, then you never went to a good Italian baker.
I've been to a few good Italian bakers, but they had other things. I guess I just didn't
know that. Oh, as a kid, I went nuts over cannolis.
I grew up in Mexico. We call those tacos.
But you haven't had a good cannoli, and you probably never will have a good dairy cannoli. But
probably not,
anyway,
no.
Anyway, so look, the world is filled with all kinds of people, and we all can't do the same thing, right?
Right.
And
right
you're up. Doing what you're doing, and that's fine and good.
Thank you.
Yes. And
my day.
So my question is, are you working on a cookbook that you want to do now?
No, you know what I'm working now on is I realize that I'd better start getting on the stick and making a living, because the cookbooks really don't support
you. I've heard
you.
That. Yeah,
they're great. They're you know, they're a wonderful calling card to get you in the door. It's a nice thing every now and then. Oh, my royalty check. Yay.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not like, you know, unless you're John Grisham or somebody, you're not going to make a living off of books.
Yeah.
So what I figure I'm going to do is I'm going to just get out there and start teaching more cooking classes and maybe writing some articles for magazine, which you do get paid nicely for. And just sort of develop a following, you know, get enough people that are interested in what I have to offer that when I do come out with a new book, there'll be a whole bunch of people to buy it, and then I can write the book that I want to write.
That sounds like a really good plan, Alan, and I want to thank you for joining me again on It's All About
Over?
Food. Excuse me?
It's over?
It's over, yes. Oh. I will see you somewhere, someday, somehow. And you're cooking.
I promise.
And you're cooking. I'm going to let you go, or you could stay on for the last minute or so, but I wanted to say this was Alan Rodinger, and he's got a new book, Almond Milk Cookbook, and we can find you at alanrodinger.com, right?
Yeah, but you better spell it, because no one will be able to tell.
ALANROETTINGER.com.
Yes, that's exactly
yes.
Right.
Right. And on the subject of teaching, I am involved right now with John and Ocean Robbins. I am so privileged to be a part of this, but we are doing a 6-week online course called Plant Powered and Thriving. It started last Tuesday, and we have our second class tonight, but, you know, you're welcome. This is the global you, my audience out there, to join in if you want to. It's been so amazing. I'm a part of it as a co-director, but I'm learning so much, and you can find out more about it at, where is it, healthy.foodrevolution.org. It's called Plant Power and Thriving, and I'm loving it. So... that's the end of the show. Thanks for joining me, Alan, and we'll see you sometime. Meanwhile, everyone, have a delicious week.